Hello, everybody. My name is Daniel Prince, and I am the host of the Once Bitten podcast. This is a podcast focused on Bitcoin. It's my mission to interview as many people as I can around the different aspects of Bitcoin and help people understand exactly what Bitcoin could mean for them and for their families and for their future. I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you so much for listening. Hey guys, welcome to this edition of the Once Bitten podcast. Very special guest. Really looking forward to getting into this one. I hope this brings something new. I was trying very desperately to rack my brains to ask different questions to Michael. And I think we did an okay job. We got into some different areas. So stick around for it and enjoy it, because it's always amazing to hear his thoughts on so many different topics. So before we get into this, make sure you head over to coinfloor.co.uk/bitten. If you're in the UK and you want to start stacking some sats, that's the place to head. And thank you, Obi, for your continued support. And welcoming new sponsors as well, swanbitcoin.com/oncebitten. If you're over across the pond there, hey guys, thank you, everybody that's listening over in that part of the world. Go start stacking your stats with Swan Bitcoin, amazing company, been put together by a bunch of Bitcoiners. Use that code /oncebitten. You'll get $10 for free and you can start your DCA journey into this world of Bitcoin as we enter this amazing bull run that we are all about to witness. Let's get into this one. Big shout out, thank you, at AdamWoodhams1 for putting all of this together, at Jim Reaper for putting together the website, once-bitten.com, and to the boys over at 21ism, you're killing it. What an amazing opening, a brilliant meme, Hodler Than Thou providing the music for that, and all of the artwork that you are showcasing, whether that's films or prints, comics, whatever it is, and all the writing and the videos as well. Head over to @21ism, go support the cause, and then click through and be sent straight across to the individual artists. Let's get into this interview. I hope you enjoy this one. Catch you after the show. Hey guys, welcome to this edition of the Once Bitten podcast, and joining me today is the Giga Chad himself, Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy. Thank you very much, Michael, for your time and joining us on the show today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I've been telling the girls that, and I don't know whether you know, but they come on and ask the first question, that they're going to meet their Uncle Chad today.
I had another uncle.
So Caitlin said to me, "Who the hell's Uncle Chad?" I didn't know we had an Uncle Chad. I'm like, well, we all have an Uncle Chad now, Caitlin, and we're going to go and chat with him. But Lauren does want to ask you the first question, and what would that be?
So I heard you like Star Wars. So my question was, who's your favorite character and why?
Well, believe it or not, Star Wars came out when I was in sixth grade. And I remember there was so much hype. It was the first big science fiction movie that was going to come out. And we stood in lines that stretched around the block for 3 hours to buy the tickets. I mean, it was such a big thing. And when we first went, I remember that they gave you this little button that said, "May the Force be with you." And all of the kids would wear this to school, and it was like the big thing that we had that no one else had, and it was a rite of passage because it was sold out for like 4 days or 5 days in a row, and you couldn't get it in any theater ever. So it was quite the cultural event. Now, my favorite character in Star Wars, Han Solo. Han Solo, why? Well, he's got the Millennium Falcon, you know, which is a pretty cool ship. Every boy of my generation wanted a space yacht. and it's kind of a space yacht, and he's got a really cool sidekick, Chewie, and he's always got good one-liners, so you got to appreciate that.
Okay, good answer for you?
Yes.
And Caitlin, what did you want to ask?
My question was, what is business intelligence?
When businesses try to make good decisions, they normally create software applications that are custom to that organization that extract insights from their data. So if a retailer was trying to figure out how much of a given item to stock in a store, they would create a custom business intelligence application that predicted how much of it they needed. And because they've got, say, 1 million items across 1,000 stores, that's 100 million combinations of buckets of items. And you have to have a different amount every day based upon all the data that's changing. So business intelligence software is software that's bought by these large companies, the Walmarts, the Amazons, and the large banks and the large governments. And they have huge volumes of information and complicated questions to answer, and they build custom applications to build them. My company builds the tools that we sell to those companies so that they can build their applications so that they can make intelligent decisions every day.
Cool.
Can I ask for an internship?
Yeah.
So thanks very much. Do you guys have any more questions for Uncle Chad before you go?
No,
I got a question to you, Daddy.
Oh.
Why do you call him Uncle Chad?
Yeah, why is he our Uncle Chad?
We're leaving that Chad? For you, Daniel. That's for you to answer.
That's turned the tables, hasn't it? Chad is a Bitcoin maximalist meme for somebody that makes bold moves and bold statements and is somebody to be looked up to and respected. And when Michael announced the ridiculously big news that many of us on Bitcoin Twitter had been waiting for, we were blown away by the percentage of the commitment that was shown when Michael and his company bought, well, in the end, $425 million worth of Bitcoin. So he's now commonly been known within the space as Giga Chad. So he's your Uncle Chad.
Yep.
Does that make sense?
Okay, it makes sense now. But you don't always have to call him Uncle Chad.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, girls. You want to say goodnight?
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Nice to meet you both.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Thanks, Michael. I'd like to ask you a question, actually, which I don't think I've heard you talk too much on, and I've listened to a lot of the other podcasts. Funny enough, actually, when we first emailed each other, you said, yeah, I'd come on the show. I've got about another 10 hours worth of stuff to talk about. And since then, I think you've done about another 10 podcasts. So I've been trying to think of different things to talk about. And one thing I'd like to explain is your education platform, Sailor.org. And the reason I ask is because I've taken my kids out of mainstream school, state education. We traveled around the world with them for 2.5 years. 3 out of the 4 are now online platform learning, self-directed education. Who just met, she chooses to go to the local college. And I think you have a quite unique take on education and what that means and where this is headed. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that, please.
Sure. Yeah, it's a subject near and dear to my heart. I grew up in a military family. My father's a non-commissioned officer. And when I graduated from high school, I think the sum total of my family's life savings for 200 years would have covered the first 6 weeks of college at MIT. But it's expensive now to go to college. It's always been expensive. It's getting more expensive. But my recollection then was the life savings of a middle-class family would pay for halfway through your first semester, and then you're bankrupt. And so the only way I went to college was I got a scholarship from the Air Force, and I went as an ROTC cadet. I joined the military. And it was that, or I just couldn't go there, right? And when I got there, it was an obscenely expensive education paid for by the United States government. And I remember my first class was physics. And I'm sitting in a physics hall, and every freshman at MIT goes through this class. And it holds like 500 people. You know? It's a 500-person lecture hall. So you can imagine sitting at the very back row of a 500-person lecture hall watching someone come out and scrape on a blackboard. And the guy is about 100 feet away from me. And we're sitting in the back, and we're scribbling down, and we're trying to follow the lectures. And then we go back to our dorm or fraternity or wherever you live, and then you study the books really hard. And then you take a test once a week. And for the privilege of that, they charged somebody, the U.S. government or individuals, they charged them about the amount that a middle-class person would save in 3 years. Expensive. Now, if you fast forward today, it occurred to me at some point that, well, couldn't we just record that and put it online on a website and let people watch the lecture online? And today, if you go to sailor.org, which is my nonprofit organization, you can find the same physics teacher and the same lecture I watched for free. And by the way, it's not just for free. It's better, because it's a lot better to start and stop the video, watch it at your own rate, and then be up close and be able to zoom in and see what the guy was scribbling on the whiteboard. So it's not just free, but it's better. Now, if you think about this entire subject deeply, and let's take mathematics. Well, when did they invent algebra? It's not 100 years old, right? It's not. Isaac Newton invented calculus and the calculus of variations, and he published Principia Mathematica, and that was what, 1776 or something. So that's like 90% of all the higher math you're ever going to learn, one guy printed in the 18th century. But most people, you know, they get through algebra and geometry. Algebra is thousands of years old. Geometry is thousands of years old, right? So here's the question. Why is there a copyright on that? Like, why do you have to pay for a textbook? Why do you have to pay for that education? By the way, why do you actually need 250,000 math teachers to teach something which is 2,000 years old, and there's only one way to teach it? It's like, you know, you wouldn't hire 250,000 people, or what would it take if we wanted to play Beethoven's Seventh Symphony in your living room with the full orchestra? Wouldn't it be prohibitively expensive to provide music in such a fashion? Like, it seems kind of ridiculous, right? Like, no, I'm not going to hire 250 musicians to play Beethoven's Seventh Symphony as my technique to give the middle-class people music. It's somewhere between silly and moronic, right? I don't know what you want to call it. But so why is it that the federal government or a university would hire someone to teach algebra? Or calculus of variations, or matrix algebra, or thermodynamics, or physics, right? In fact, if you look at all the mathematics and computer science and engineering disciplines, and then you ask, what are all the things you learn in college? And then you say, what's the portion of a college education that can be decomposed into virtual education, and what's the portion that requires physical education? Well, I get the country club aspects of school. Like, sometimes you're actually paying for school because you need someone to babysit the kid, or you want to play tennis, or you want to meet people, or you want to walk through, you want to play golf, or you want to play intramural sports. or you need a place to live, right? There's that element. And then there's the element of learning calculus. And now we get to this issue of if I hire 100,000 people to teach calculus, are they all equivalent in quality, or is somebody better than somebody else? Presumably in a bell curve, there's someone who's the best teacher and someone that's the worst teacher and everybody in the middle, you know, and we only listen to Beethoven or Brahms or Mozart, right? It was the Price's Law. You know, they say like there's five, this is Jordan, I'm channeling Jordan Peterson. There's like five classical musicians that are responsible for 50% of all music we listen to. And there's like 5% of their works that are responsible for 50% of that. So what's the idea behind Sailor Academy? The idea is, why don't we just make education free for everybody forever? And could you? Well, I can't make golf and ballet lessons free for everybody forever, or yoga is not, you know, I can't quite do some of these things, but jittered bug square dancing lessons. And you know, if you want to like a laboratory, maybe I can't quite get that free, but anything that's virtually teachable, in theory, you can decompose to the textbook, the lecture, the online examination, the exercises. If you do that, then you should be able to upload it. And if you upload it, you should be able to reduce the variable cost from, what is it? Like it's $250,000 of variable cost for a high-end college education in the United States today. Well, shouldn't the variable cost be reduced to the depreciation on the computer and the electricity? So yes. What is the real variable cost? If you wanted to learn if you wanted to learn math, shouldn't you be able to get a mathematics degree for about $97 in electricity, or maybe it's $19 of electricity instead of $250,000? So I started thinking about that, and I started this more than a decade ago, and the idea was simply create an online university. Now, I have one other observation on this subject, Dan, which is if you want to cure cancer or invent a fusion reactor or go to Mars, or if you want to solve the problem of global warming, whatever your problem is, you want to clean the oceans of the earth, all of the really difficult problems in the world probably require more than a high school education. In fact, if you think about school, right, high school gets you to the point where you can move through polite society. University undergrad gets you to the point where you recognize knowledge exists everywhere. A master's degree gets you to the point where you're a master practitioner in some area given a set of tools. And a PhD, theoretically, is defined as the point at which you've mastered a body of knowledge enough to make a seminal contribution to the civilization. If you have a PhD in biochemistry, in theory, you're supposed to be able to make a unique contribution to the body of knowledge in the human civilization. Ergo, you want to solve really difficult problems, you need to get to the graduate, postgraduate, PhD level. And last I checked, there were like 10 million PhDs in the world. I mean, 10 million to 20 million, but I think it was like 10 million. And there's 7.5 billion people in the world. So you want to make the world a better place, you need about 1 billion PhDs. Well, I mean, what we really want, right, is we don't really want 250,000 people to teach algebra and calculus and geometry. What you want is the computer to teach algebra and calculus and geometry, because the computer's, first of all, it's free. Second of all, it's on demand. Third of all, it's probably better, much richer in every rich way, you know, augmented with software tools, right? Like you want to learn to build an airplane, I give you the lectures and I give you the airplane simulator and I give you the wind tunnel, and you design your airplane and the simulated wind tunnel snaps the wings off and you try it again and you don't kill anybody. And eventually you know how to design an airplane or at least a nice glider. That makes sense. We can do that for 1 million people for a nickel, right? So, I mean, or Or you can spend $250,000 at MIT, which is the other approach. But it does take a rocket scientist to figure out the problem here, which is there's no way you can afford. Well, what's it cost for a PhD? A billion people times, it's $1 million to get a PhD. Maybe 500,000 on a budget in the Western world. And, you know, let's just say 500,000 times a billion. How much is that? Right? 1,000 billion is a trillion, right? 500,000 is $500 trillion. A lot of money. So even if you had the $500 trillion, right, who's got, you know, can we actually do it the old fashioned way with bricks and mortars institutions? The answer is no, it's an intellectually bankrupt idea. But it's kind of a silly idea, right? Like, why in the world do I have to actually pay that much money to learn? How many people do you know that you went to school with that knew more mathematics than Isaac Newton knew? Because I don't know many, right? Not many. Isaac Newton put it all in the public domain, Dan, 200 years ago. And yet right now the impediment is a bunch of gatekeepers. People charging expensive money for textbooks, expensive courses, you know, expensive certifications. And we're going to hold back all these people because they don't have $500,000 to get a master's or a PhD in mathematics, even though the information's in the public domain. And you could argue, well, you can download Principia Mathematica from Google, but, you know, we want to augment it. There's a lot of ways to augment it. So the fundamental issue is education's too expensive, but it shouldn't be. And we need a lot more of it. And the only way to get a lot more of it is to A, drive the variable cost to zero, and B, create software to teach people. You know, the software can, people will say, well, I need to go do this. Well, you're not really. I mean, you can like create a virtual simulation. What happens when a 4-year-old kid can create a bridge in a simulation and then build a bigger one and a bigger one and then apply an earthquake to it and then blow a wind past it and hit it with a Cat 5 storm and then watch it and then change the material on it and then drive cars over it and put trucks on it and then have a really heavy truck smash it and then rebuild the bridge the right way? And they can do that all instead of watching Netflix between ages of 4 and 8. Maybe we'll find some real emergent geniuses like the Mozarts, like the Gausses, like the Isaac Newtons of the world, because we give them those kind of tools. I wasn't going to MIT without an Air Force scholarship. I wasn't going, and I wasn't getting those lectures, and there was no internet. And now, you know, I guess the best that can be said is today you can kind of bypass that and go to YouTube, but we still don't have as much formalized structured education as we need. So my passion around the Sailor Academy and Sailor.org is let's just make education free to everybody forever. And we're just biting off one thing at a time. You know, the STEM, science, technology, engineering courses are the easiest ones. Undergraduate. We first started doing that. Then we started doing cross accreditation with other universities. In the next 36 months, we expect to get to the point where we're a degree granting university and it'll flip to be the Sailor University. And then anybody can get a full degree and we'll expand the course offerings, you know, as time and capability allow. That's the ideal.
Man, I'm all in. I love it. This is music to my ears. I've been beating the drum against like the education system for, well, since we left it. It wasn't until we left it and looked at it from, you know, an outsider looking in and from first principles that you realize what it is and what it's become and what it was actually ever meant to be. And, you know, just a way to organize society and create factory workers or soldiers. And it's pretty much the same system. So what you're doing, I think, is absolutely incredible. And this ties in nicely, actually, to what I want to talk about, because I've been hearing you talk about the virtual wave a lot. And obviously your first book was The Mobile Wave. So one, I'm getting thinking perhaps there's a new book coming out at some stage called The Virtual Wave. But this idea of everything going virtual and what you've faced at MicroStrategy, pretty much going from brick and mortar company to virtual company in the course of days and taking on brick and mortar educational system and taking that virtual as well. Where else are we going to go virtual? And are you going to write another book?
You know, I wrote The Mobile Wave. And, you know, I kind of lay it out a future, which is a future where Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google dematerialize everybody. And I think I made $50,000 in royalties on that book and nobody read it. On the other hand, you invest $50 million in those stocks, you would have made 10 to 20X your money. So it the lesson I learned, by the way, I invested in the stocks, made a lot of money. My company got the benefit of me marketing the book, you know, and I got $50,000 in royalties. And I made a promise to myself, if this happens again, I'm not going to write the book. I'm going to buy the thing, as much of it as I could possibly buy, and then I'll talk about it. And so the virtual wave is kind of an inversion of that. You know, the company invested its $500 million in the virtual wave, and in this case, it's virtual gold or virtual monetary energy called Bitcoin. And I'll talk about it, but nobody wants to read books anymore. At least by the time they read the book, it'll be over. So, you know, authors don't really get the rewards. You know, you have to actually take action. So, yeah, maybe one day I'll write the book, but I kind of rather think that people, they learn via YouTube podcast and YouTube videos and the like. So you're probably better off just to take action and tweet about the thing, which is how I feel about that. Well, let's talk about the virtual wave. I mean, the virtual wave is fascinating. The mobile wave was the dematerialization of a lot of stuff that could touch a mobile device. The virtual wave is the dematerialization of a bunch of other stuff, a bunch of people, a bunch of processes, a bunch of products. And if we let's take university or education, you know, the virtual wave has really accelerated the dematerialization of education and the decomposition of it. I don't think people in the education business even understand what's happened, because the first thing that happens is you shut down the campuses. And then people start to go online and they attend classes online. But if you think about it, as soon as you start to attend classes online, you realize that, you know, maybe the platforms you're using aren't right. And maybe the teacher you've got doesn't teach very well online. And then you're sitting in a very slow slot, you know, stodgy lecture. And then you go on YouTube and you realize you can find a better lecture online on YouTube from someone that isn't at your university. So if I'm really going to learn thermodynamics, you know, online from my professor at MIT, maybe I would rather learn thermodynamics online from the person that won the Nobel Prize, or maybe I'd rather go to the Khan Academy, or I'm going to study the history of Winston Churchill or somebody like that. Maybe I'll just go online and listen to the speech myself. Maybe I'll just go online and learn from Winston Churchill himself. He gave a speech. I might find that on YouTube. So it starts to screw with your views. When I talk to my executives, I say, you know, you can now zoom anywhere at the speed of light and you can bend time and space. So what are you going to do with that power? And the bending of time and space it screws with people, because they don't really... Everybody likes the idea that, oh, I can stay home and Zoom somewhere. That's not that threatening. Okay, here's the threatening part. We used to have 40 hours worth of meetings in person, and 75% of it was a presentation. And then we went virtual. We found that we could just ask people to record the presentation as a video and submit it in advance of the meeting. And so now my 40 hours of meetings became 8 hours of meetings. And you know what happens if I give you a 2-hour video of all my thoughts? You run it at 150% speed. No, when you're watching something for entertainment, you watch it at 1 hour equals 1 hour. But when you're listening to someone for educational purposes, you listen to 1 hour equals 1.5 hours, or 1 hour equals 2 hours. So you speed listen, because most people talk kind of slow and take a while to get to the point, and it drives you nuts. So you're immediately more productive. And then, of course, they start telling you something you already know, so you skip. So when you're actually listening for education, you go twice as fast, and you might go 4 times as fast. So now it changes your view, which is, why would I invite 25 people to a meeting to listen to someone talk for 1 hour? I could just send 25 people the video and they can figure it out. But half the people already know the stuff before they get the video. They already know it. Only 3 people in the meeting that are learning anything. And so now you start saying, well, what if I had the ability to learn everything I wanted on demand at my speed when I want to? And then the next thing is, well, why do I got to learn it from you? Well, in business, what that means is our 40 hours of meetings become 4 hours of meetings. Okay, you had to what am I going to do with the rest of my time? Okay, I want to suggest another disturbing idea for you. What if every time you met with me, I already knew what you were going to say before you opened your mouth? You know, what would our meetings consist of? Like, let's say you work for me and you run engineering, and I already know everything you're going to say and every presentation before our meeting starts. So the meeting starts like it used to be, very comforting. Like, you lecture me for 45 minutes, and at the end of the meeting, I ask a couple of questions, we talk. You get to warm up. In the virtual wave, the meeting starts at 8 a.m., and it goes like this. Click, click. How are you, Dan? I'm good. So, Dan, why is it going to take you 6 weeks to do that with 4 people? Why can't you do it with 2 people in 2 weeks? And I don't really want that feature. And you go, well, I guess we could do that. And I said, well, so, and if you do this, can we do this, this, and this? You're like, well, I thought so, but I can't do it. Last thing. Okay, so let's do the first 7 things and do it in half the time with half the people, right? Okay, click, 8.03 a.m., meeting done.
Yes.
But what do I do? Like a 3-minute meeting? The only reason to have a meeting with anybody anymore is negotiation, interrogation, collaboration. I'm gonna interrogate you and collaborate a little bit and negotiate, and then we're gonna settle and the meeting's over. So why would anybody ever come to a meeting that isn't gonna be party to the negotiation? So that 40 people in the room that took 40 hours becomes like 4 people in 15 minutes. And now what are you supposed to do with yourself? Now let's take that to education. Well, everybody got kicked out of school. Well, so the next thing is, you got to educate your daughters yourself. So now you're not limited to what the teacher at school, you know, you have a 4th grade teacher. What's the odds that they're the world's best geometry teacher? Not high. What's the odds that they're the best, you know, history teacher? Not high. What's the odds that they're kind of average and moderately mediocre in every possible way? Pretty high. You know, if they're the world's best musician or world's best mathematician or world's best teacher, they would be doing it in front of an audience of 800,000 people, right? And they are, by the way, on YouTube or somewhere. Okay, so it kind of sends you into this interesting spiral, which is, why don't I just go and put together a stack of things for my family to learn? And then why don't they learn them at their own rate? Right? There's that classic, right? You're really going to handcuff everybody to a desk and make them listen for 8 hours straight, and they're going to get 1 hour of this and 1 hour of this and 1 hour of this and 1 hour of this. And if they're smarter than everybody else in the class, they get dumbed down. And if they're dumber or they're slower than everybody in the class, they get left behind. And if everybody in the class goes exactly at the same rate in a regimented fashion for 18 years or for 12 years, then you get to graduate from high school. So what do? We had a regimented, mediocre 12-year slog, which tests your fortitude and your patience. And if anybody gets out of control, we dose them with Adderall. You know, give them a prescription drug. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. And what does make a lot of sense? By the way, you want another interesting observation, Dan? Since the virtual wave hit, if someone asked to meet with me, I get really irritated at having someone present to me IRL, like in real life. Or that's to say, if you're presenting to me where 1 minute equals 1 minute, and I don't have a stop, start, skip button and a speed up button on you, it's really an imposition. It makes me impatient. Like, I'm very impatient now. Like, another way to say it is, like, you wanted to spend 2 hours of my Monday talking to me about something. Why didn't you submit the video in advance so that I could cover your 2 hours in like 37 minutes on a Saturday afternoon, so that I could actually reclaim my time during the working day to do something useful? I'm irritated that you're forcing me to take 120 minutes and think as slowly as you speak, right? But it's, everybody can listen 50% faster than you can talk. Everybody. Yeah. Try it. Go back on YouTube, pick anything, punch it up to 150%. Okay, so now don't you think I just gave you a third of your life back? And so now let's take that to school. Let's apply that to 16 years of education. Can you imagine putting 1 billion people through 16 years of 2,000 hours of mediocre, regimented, authoritarian, you know, force-fed, lowest common denominator, you know, dogma? Mm-hmm. It sounds like a recipe for brainwash mediocrity, or at least, but forget about the, you know, your value, your view as to whether it's a better or worse way to educate someone. Doesn't it sound like an expensive way to do it? It's like custom manufacturing everything. So how about a better way to do it? What if I just uploaded everything you wanted to know as streaming on demand from kindergarten all the way through 20th grade? And then what if the parents are, you know, maybe you want to homeschool your children, but maybe what you want to do is gather with a neighborhood group. If you want your children to be together for social reasons, maybe the emergence of a village or neighborhood school system where there's one tutor, and that one tutor guides the children. And if you've got a daughter that's going to actually get through calculus of variations by age 14, fine. Let her go that fast. If you have, you know, someone that wants to learn civil engineering, you know, when I went to school, you were allowed to learn Latin or Spanish. I think maybe French. French or Latin or Spanish. Those were your three choices. Okay, so like what was the odds I was going to master Russian or Chinese? It was like I wasn't getting that. Now you think about it today and you think, well, why can't we just give everyone the ability to learn everything for free whenever they want? And the answer is, well, we can. So I think you've got three things in the education establishment right now that are vying, contending with each other. On one hand, you've got the mission of educating. And you can take, what is this, like $1 trillion a year industry, something, it's some god-awful expensive. You can take that and collapse that by a factor of 1,000 or 10,000. Like if the United States government invested a few billion dollars a year, they could upload all of the courseware and just about everything you could imagine and maintain it every year for like 0.1% of the amount of money we spend on education. So the production of education intellectually, that's the problem that can be solved technically. And the second problem you have is the certification regulation, you know, of education. It's like You know, I used to meet with people and I go, you know, we can teach all these courses in Virginia. You know, we can like provide free education for all the nurses in Virginia on 75% of their courses. And the person's like, well, that's good. We're not going to give that to West Virginia, are we? We don't want them to have it. I'm like, well, but, you know, but. Okay, I'm about to say, well, you know, we can actually give it to Pakistan and India and the world. And they're angry that we're going to give it to West Virginia. Because we only want to do that in Virginia. Because we can't have people from other states getting the benefit of that. So there's an entire education establishment that wants to control this by a certification and registration and licensing. That's a political problem. It's not a technical problem at all. You have to actually find somebody that wants to educate the world. Most of what we have is all about creating scarcity and the credentials, right? We all know about digital scarcity. There's a lot of creating scarcity of educational credentials in order to hold prices up. And then the third part of education, right, is the country club, nursery school, babysitter, you know, bricks and mortar aspect. That's just in loco parentis, you know, from K through 20, you know, something to do. That's not going to be solved quickly and easily by technology. What happened this year is people had to stop and reassess their views on education. Now, you asked about virtual wave. I think this is just rippling like a wave through everything. The real question is, to what degree can you virtualize and dematerialize the product or the service? And it's a cultural issue as well as a political issue, more so than a technical issue. But I rather think, I think when the dust settles, I think people are going to realize that a lot of concepts are obsolete and they need to be reformed in a different fashion because of the virtual wave. The way, especially the concept of local, for example, I say to people, the definition of local is you speak my language and you're in my time zone. Like you're awake in my time zone. We're local right now, as long as you speak fluent English and you're awake. And to the extent that you're not awake and you can't speak my language, then you're different. So if I redefine that, then what's the point of having local schools and local universities and local businesses and local practitioners, like a local doctor? At some point, local accountants, local service providers, all that's bending. And this, you know, when that happens, the second thing that happens is you start to ask the question, what can be automated and what requires a person? And the third thing that happens is it totally breaks down all the labor barriers, because why can't I, you know, have the labor coming from Eastern Europe, and then why couldn't it come from any jurisdiction? And what if I don't know what the jurisdiction is? And so you've got a massive heat exchange. A balancing of energies, where instead of hiring why do I want to hire a $250,000 a year accountant if I can find someone that speaks English, that knows accounting, that costs $25,000 a year, that lives somewhere else? As long as if you work the late shift in Europe, it's the same as working the normal shift in the U.S. And so that means somebody in Lithuania is just as local as someone in New Jersey if they speak English and they want to download New Jersey tax code. And I think that's going to ripple through everything and a lot of things. And there's good to it and there's bad to it. And the implications, a lot of people haven't quite grasped yet, but they're happening pretty rapidly.
So rapidly. And you are clearly at the forefront of this. And what kind of blows me away, and many of the other Bitcoiners in the space that have seen you come into Bitcoin, understand it, like the way you understand it and the way that you tweet about it, and very, so far deep down the rabbit hole. That was such a quick fall down to grasp all of those. It's taken me like 5 years, like, just to try and piece all this together. So either your mind is just rapid and it just gets all of these things and puts the pieces of the puzzle together, or I don't know, this, like, this virtual wave that you're talking about, the Bitcoin wave that you're talking about, you've been CEO of MicroStrategy for 31, 32 years. Is that right?
Yeah, since 1989.
Right. And now I'm just wondering, what do the people around you, what do they see? What do they, like, all of a sudden, we were doing business one way, 30 years of doing business and slight iterations, and now all of a sudden, completely on its head. And I've heard you say before, you're the kind of CEO that would never even think about remote work. Now you've flipped that on the head and you see the virtual wave clearer than anyone. You can talk about it clearer than anyone. You've gone so balls deep into Bitcoin, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. What are people around you, they must just see like this completely different person, or... Or are you prone to these kind of U-turns before?
Well, first of all, the job of the CEO is to guide the organization and to react to changes in the environment. So it's no different than the job of every leader of every organization right now. And what you have is some people taking decisive action. There's plenty of them. I'm not the only one. I'm probably an obvious one in Bitcoin. I'm not the only one in Bitcoin. There are a lot of other very decisive movers in Bitcoin. You know, Stoneridge is a very decisive mover in Bitcoin. You know, what Jack Dorsey's doing at Square is very decisive in Bitcoin. You know, what PayPal is doing is very decisive in Bitcoin. So there's a lot of decisiveness going on. You should give yourself credit, Dan. And I pointed this out to Dan Held, too. You know, so you took 5 years to figure it out. But I had 5 years of you figuring out to accelerate me. The basis of crypto is this idea of proof of work. And the idea of proof of work is you exert an obscene amount of time and energy, or obscene amount of energy and encryption power in order to solve a problem, which then it's a billion times quicker for every other node to validate that you solved the problem, that you did the work. So the asymmetry is the secret to how the network works. And so how do things spread in time? Like, for example, I'm an engineer. I'm not a scientist. Newton, you want geniuses. Newton, Einstein, Mozart, Beethoven. They extracted stuff from the ether that you couldn't do in a million years, that I couldn't do in a million years. If I tried a billion years, I couldn't do it. I mean, for thousands of years, humanity worked without the calculus of variations in calculus. And Newton, that one guy, probably contributed 90% of everything around us. That one person looked up and extracted so much physics, astrophysics. Now, took him a lot of work or a lot of something. How about every single math student that came along after him? How long did it take them to figure out that calculus was useful? Like, you think it's hard for me to figure out that calculus is useful? No, an engineer figures it out. I'm an engineer. An engineer is not dogmatic or what would be religiously against things that work. I give you a chip. I give you a math. I give you a component. I give you steel. Okay, it's not, by the way, is it hard to figure out that steel's a good thing? Not really. Is it? How hard is it to build a building with steel? It takes some effort. Do you want a steel building? Yeah. If I gave you $500 million and I said build a big building, would you use steel? Yeah. Now, could you invent steel? Could you create the first steel factory, a steel refinery? That's hard. Right? Steel refineries blow up. They kill everybody. Right? We could spend 10,000 years trying to work that out. That's, if you ever studied, you know, metallurgy, right? Materials. When you get to the part where you're studying steel, it's pretty intense. And they give you all these thick books, 1,000 pages, steam tables, you know, and what's the right amount of carbon to mix into, you know, into iron to get steel? Very complicated. I look at it and I think I would never in a million years want to have to have figured that out. But I'm happy to accept the gift. Yeah. I'm happy to accept it. And so proof of work is like someone did a lot of work, but you don't have to be as much horsepower to figure out that the hash function is right as you did to actually do it in the first place. And that's why this stuff spreads fast, because you did your work, Dan did his work, VJ did his work, right? All the maximalists did their work. They had less information and they had more uncertainty. And so it took a lot more effort. You had to think more deeply. I did my work, but I had a lot more information. It only took me a few months to come to the conclusion, because I had a lot more information. Then I invested 20 years worth of earnings in a few weeks. Okay. I took 20, you talk about work, right? I took 20 years of energy and I put it on the blockchain in 4 weeks. And then I made it public. I published the hash function, right? And I said, I did all my work. I looked at everybody else's work. And then I printed a block, and my block is $500 million, or actually $600 million worth of energy. That was the total nominal amount of cash I put into the blockchain. And I put it out there, and now I leave it as an issue. If you have $600 million, you can go back and spend 6 years and do what Dan Prince did, or you can do what Vijay Boyapati did, or you can do what Dan Hell did, and you can think about that. Or you can spend the 1 month and you can go to hope.com and read everything Michael Saylor read. Or you can skip that and you can just say, hey, here's a dude that put $600 million into the blockchain because he thinks it's the first true digital monetary network in the history of the world. And it's the Facebook of money. And I think what people don't get, not everybody gets, I think they don't realize there's investors out there. They're just looking for an idea this month. I have $10 billion. I have to put $500 million in something. Okay, what's this idea? Okay, guy puts $500 million into Bitcoin. Why? Well, because he thinks it's the ultimate safe haven asset. It's better than gold and it's going to be like Facebook. Yeah, and he put the $500 million in? Yeah, let me read that again. Okay, give me some of that. They don't have to go down the rabbit hole, right? They don't have to do the work that you did any more than a node has to do the work to validate that the block is good. They just have to read the hash, right? It's a question of, do they trust me, right? And by the way, not everybody does, but you don't got to convince everybody, Dan. You just got to convince anybody, right? There's 10,000 billion dollar entities. All you got to do is convince a handful of them. And by the way, you don't have to convince them as much as me. I said, well, I've looked at it. It makes sense that I'm going to put substantially all of my free cash into this. You know, at the company level, I had $500 million in cash. I'm going to either buy my stock back or buy Bitcoin with it as fast as I can. But you wouldn't have, I mean, that's a treasury reserve asset commitment. You could copy that. But you could also say, well, I'm Paul Tudor Jones. I have $10 billion. I'll just put $500 million into this. That's a much lesser commitment. You know, there are people that'll put $500 million into a bad idea. If you've got $100 billion in your portfolio, you might bet $500 million expecting you'll get 100-to-1 return 1% of the time or 5% of the time. I think that's a good idea. So I think that's why, everything's accelerating, right? And it's a fire, right? As I said, it's a campfire, then it's a bonfire, then it's a forest fire. And you're like, well, I don't get it. Why is the fire like spreading twice as fast? Well, because it's an exponential process. Because it's spreading twice as fast, because twice as many. At the end of the day, by the way, it's important that 100 million people embrace Bitcoin, but there's 10 people that can triple the price of Bitcoin. 10. Right? This is not like Facebook. I make this point. Like, nobody ever brought 1 billion friends to Facebook. This is not like Facebook. This is like when a person with $10 billion decides that they want to adopt this network and they put $2 or $3 billion on the network, that's going to be more monetary energy that flowed in the network than the first 10 million people put in the network. It's a 10 million to one game.
Yep.
But, you know, here's the other thing. When a person with $10 billion puts $10 billion on the network, they've got a friend with $10 billion, right? Warren Buffett plays bridge with Bill Gates.
Right.
You know, and then they talk with Mark Zuckerberg. So when this hits that social network, it's like, okay, well, 1 billion to 2 billion to 4 billion to 8 billion. And those four decisions, those four blocks have more impact on the network than the first 10 million blocks. And so that's what's driving Bitcoin and what I expect is going to drive it. But we all stand on the shoulders of somebody, right? I mean, that human civilization and engineering is based on the idea that you figure out how someone else worked this out, you copy it, and then you do it. And if you try to reinvent the wheel yourself, right, no chance. At some point, you got to figure out who you're going to trust.
Are your friends and family, like, do they question? Are you like the rest of us, annoying Bitcoin guy at the dinner table?
You know, it's like it gets in your head, doesn't it? And then pretty soon it just kind of, you can't get it out of your head. You start talking about it. Yeah, like Max Kaiser, the high priest of Bitcoin. He's like, you know, it's Bitcoin, Bitcoin, Bitcoin. It's going to get you. It's going to cleanse you. I love Max. I think, and other people, they don't understand it until they understand it. And then they get it. It's like that conversation with Keith McCullough, you know, and it's like, he's going, well, when I sell Bitcoin, and I said, well, Keith, if you understood Bitcoin, you could never sell Bitcoin. Like, nobody that understands it could sell it. If you're trading it, you don't understand it. You know, it's a shiny object, like a lure spinning at the end of a fish hook. And you're thinking somehow that you're playing with the stupid shiny object, like juggling fire or something. And it hasn't occurred to you, you know, I give you the gift of fire. You can change the civilization. It's the most important thing of humanity. And you're trying to juggle these little sparklers on the 4th of July, right? You either get it or you don't get it. But once you get it, you're like, well, hey, we invented fire here. I got to explain this to you. This is important. This is a big deal. It's not a shiny lure at the end of a fish hook.
That interview, thanks on behalf of the whole Bitcoin community for going on. I couldn't watch half of it just because of the other guy and how disingenuous he is. And then when he followed up with the comments and the whole thing, the guy is just, yeah. Are you blocked, by the way? Are you part of the Blocks Brigade?
I'm not blocked. I noticed all the hornets got blocked. I thought that was really funny. I thought that was great. But look,
well, memes were.
He's got some people, you know, on Hedgeye, and we want them to hear about Bitcoin. And so it's an opportunity to spread Bitcoin. And if he talks about Bitcoin, then that's good for Bitcoin. And so I think we got to deal with that. I'm not a big fan of traders and financiers. Like, in general, I think when we start to talk about trading and when we characterize Bitcoin as, oh, it's a call option. It's an uncorrelated asset. You know, I've got this macroeconomic model. You know, what I want to do is I want to shake all these people and say, I give you the gift of fire. It's elevating the human race above the animals and it's going to be the key to human civilization and us spreading throughout the galaxy. And you want to juggle it?
This is nuts. Anyway, when we hit all time high, perhaps send him over a bottle of Screaming Eagle Cab Sav just to so he can cry into a glass of that. But I want to ask you about MicroStrategy. Have any of the employees reached out to you about this? What's been the within within the company?
You know, we have a very technically adept employee base. You know, they're software engineers. We create software. We sell software. We support the software. We build applications, and all the software is about intelligence. So this has been, a real shot in the arm. I mean, I think they like this. They're excited about Bitcoin. They're excited about the potential of crypto. I think it's been a real great source of enthusiasm, and it's good for morale for us to be doing a good thing and be forward thinking with regard to the technology. And it opens up a lot of really nice opportunities for the company.
Yeah, tons. And I wanted to ask you about, are you already thinking about things that you can build out to support Bitcoin, new Bitcoin companies that are coming into the space that need business intelligence? Is that thing that you guys are already looking at and thinking about?
Yeah, we are. I mean, one of the reasons we want to run our own node, and in addition to just generally contributing to network security and selfishly protecting our own interest, we also think that's a great source of clean data. And so we use the node to extract the blockchain, and the blockchain becomes our data set. And that data set is, of course, quite interesting to anybody with the $250 billion of money on the blockchain and all those wallets. We've got some really good technology for manipulating and analyzing data sets. And we've got hyper intelligence technology for creating hypercards that give you insight into those large data sets. And so what you'll see is what we're going to do next is start to release hyper intelligence for the blockchain or for the Bitcoin blockchain. And I think that'll be interesting to the community. And then make that hyper intelligence available in a SaaS multi-tenant environment so that anybody can build their own Bitcoin related hypercards in a matter of minutes. And then they can embed them in those applications and they can use them in order to enrich their offerings or to make better decisions. And we'll follow up with other technologies, business intelligence technology that's plugged right into to the blockchain data set.
And what's your thoughts around like the pushback against chain analysis and that being bad for privacy and for people that have, you know, been hodling on the blockchain for many years and would prefer privacy over analytics?
I think that there's a pretty rich market right now of different companies providing different capabilities all integrated with the Bitcoin standard, right? And so you've got, for those people that want to self-custody, right? If I'm the crypto anarchist, you know, and I want to be ready for after the zombie apocalypse, whatever, you know, when the internet goes down, there's offerings for them. And that's good. If I want to hold all of my my own monetary energy, there's offerings for them. And if I want extreme privacy, you've got Zcash, you've got Monero. There's a competitive market for privacy, right? And which one will win? Will Zcash win? Will Monero win? Will something else win? Unclear. We will find out. There's a competitive market for crypto banks like Kraken, and they're regulated in Wyoming, and there's KYC obligations. And there's plenty of people that want to buy Bitcoin on a regulated KYC bank, right? I mean, and why would you? Because it's illegal not to. Like I can't go ahead and buy on a decentralized exchange without KYC as a public company officer, right? So Fidelity and Coinbase and Kraken, they all have their place. Now, Binance has a much richer offering, has the spot market against the futures market. And when I go to Binance, I salivate. I'm like, oh, this is great, man. Wouldn't it be cool to short the forward and buy the spot and lock in the spread? And And then I read the part where it says, except if you're a U.S. citizen. I'm like, okay, well, not for me. But it's out there for somebody. Mm-hmm. And how do I feel about it? Am I going to leave the United States so that I can trade on Binance? No. Like, do I think it's good for Bitcoin? Yes. Now, if Bitcoin was known as the network of absolute complete privacy, it would be counterproductive to the interest of Bitcoin. Because right now, the regulators in most countries, there's two use cases. There's multiple use cases, right? There's one use case, store of value over a long period of time. There's another use case, medium of exchange for coffee. There's a third use case, buying stuff in an uncensored way so that governments can't stop. There are three different use cases. Now, which of the three is most important? I happen to think there's a $250 trillion value to store a value. What's it? We can store all $250 trillion that's in bonds and equity and precious metals and investment commercial real estate on the blockchain, on the Bitcoin network, with the current bandwidth, with the current block size, with the current settlement speeds. We can store all $250 trillion forever and keep it safe for 100 years, 200 years, 500 years. Is that valuable? Yeah. Is that enough? Yeah, actually, that's enough. Like, do you need to have more value proposition than 250? Let me say it again. We can store $250 trillion forever. Okay, so you think there's a problem with the value proposition of a $250 billion network? I don't think so. Boy, one day there'll be more than $250 trillion. We can store, what's like $2,500 trillion? How much is that? It's a lot of money, right? Quadrillion something? We can store that much money on the network forever. That's enough. It's good. Now, you want to buy a pizza or a coffee? Would I use Bitcoin Cash? No, I would use Apple Pay. I would use, you know, would I use Square or PayPal? I wouldn't even use PayPal or Square, right? I mean, I wouldn't bother to download another tool. I would use Apple Pay. But you might use Square, or you might use PayPal, or you might use, you know, Google Pay, or you might use something on Amazon. Am I going to use a crypto network? No, probably not. If you're doing something which is compliant with and is not multi-jurisdictional, you don't need a crypto. You absolutely need a crypto as store of value for the next, you know, 500 years across all jurisdictions. It's pretty obvious if you want virtual gold, you need crypto. You don't need crypto to buy a pizza. It's a silly notion. It's silly to say you're gonna run Bitcoin 20 times faster by doubling the block size because Apple Pay is going to run it 20 billion times faster. Oh, but like, if I'm a criminal on the run, I can't order a pizza with Apple Pay. Yeah, I guess. Give me a list. Like, what percentage of the world is concerned about that use case? I don't think many. So I don't really see the value proposition for routine medium of exchange being dominated by crypto. I think that centralized networks, right? Look, the real question is, will Square be able to compete against Apple Pay? That's the question. That's the hard thing. There is zero chance that a crypto network is competing against Apple Pay. And there is zero need, because the average person doesn't need to put more than 5% of their monetary energy into a mobile wallet in any given period, right? If you had $100,000, you're putting $95,000 in a savings account, $5,000 in a checking account, if that, maybe $2,000 in a checking account, and then you sweep it in. So for your sweep working capital accounts, you're going to use centralized banks, mobile banks, or conventional banks. And that takes me to privacy. Is there a place for privacy and censorship resistance? Sure there is. Who's going to do it? Probably some special purpose crypto network will develop it. What's wrong with just sweeping your money into that thing? You know, if what you want to do is have a bunch of non-censorable non-trackable pure cash transactions do that. Is there compliance risk? Yeah, a lot. Right? Will governments attack it? Certainly. You know, will the Chinese? You bet. Right? They're attacking Bitcoin. What do you think they do about privacy coin? Right? Well, the Russians? The Russians have not shut down Bitcoin, but they'll shut down privacy coin. Will the American government? Probably. Like, it seems to me like it's putting a bullseye in your forehead. So you have a choice. Daniel, I'll ask you this question. If you had a choice, you could make Bitcoin completely private, uncensorable, dark web, untraceable tomorrow. Or you could wait for Bitcoin's price to go to $1 million. And then we could talk about it again. Which of the two would you choose?
It's a great question. And I get turned upside down on this because the non-KYC and the KYC coin debate. And I think if in 5 to 10 years time we have a two-tiered market for these coins, I think most people are just assuming that the non-KYC coins are going to trade higher. I think it could be the other way around because we'll be so much further down the road where Bitcoin is so much more acceptable by so many more people and more regulations and governments around the world that the non-KYC coins could be the ones with taint, as we use in air quotes, might trade at a discount.
You've got a two-tier market now. Like, you've got one. It's called Zcash and Monero and Bitcoin. You have a two-tier market. The market's already put a price on them. You can go figure it out. The price of a privacy coin is trading at 1/200th or 1/100th of the price of Bitcoin. The market's already given you the answer. By the way, it's common sense. Who do you think's got more money in the world? The people, the institutions that are subject to government jurisdiction and regulation, or people that aren't subject to regulatory jurisdiction? Like, for example, you think I could buy a non-KYC coin?
No,
like, I can't. Like, you think it's a debate? Like, you think there's a debate there? You think I had an option? Do you think that any institutional investor in the world has an option to choose whether or not they'll go the KYC channel or the non-KYC channel? There's not a single institution. No one that's going to invest more than $10 million in Bitcoin could possibly go the non-KYC route. And maybe no more than, maybe $1 million is the cutoff. I don't know what the number is, but here's what I can tell you off the top of my head. 99% of the money has to be going through a KYC route, which means 99% of the value of Bitcoin is based upon the fact that it's not threatening to the status quo. What do you think happens to any bank that says to the United States government, we're not going to report the $10,000 wire transfers? What happens to that bank? And how long would it take for that to happen?
Yeah.
Okay, so you run a bank. Daniel, the bank's got $250 billion in it. You have a choice. Your bank can become 100 times bigger and you can comply to some degree, or you can send a letter to the local government saying you've chosen not to comply and you're going to do everything you possibly can to not comply. Your bank's going to go to zero. You know, maybe if you're lucky, it'll go to 1% of what it is. And again, what did you gain there? Like, what was the benefit? Because 99% of the money simply, 99% of the money doesn't have a choice. They can't one way or the other. And we can have an intellectual debate, a philosophical debate about the virtues of privacy and censorship resistance versus the virtue of store of value. But here's one thing that's pretty clear. The likelihood that a politician will allow you to engineer a system that that stores monetary energy without power loss is much higher than the likelihood that a politician will let you engineer a system to launder money. I mean, it's kind of that simple, right? If you say to people, Bitcoin is virtual gold and you can hold and it works better than gold, and we're going to use it because it's a monetary energy network that doesn't have a power bleed. It's an engineering system. I get it. Bitcoin is a way to avoid the $10,000 limit on wire transfers and KYC. That's an altogether different thing. That's a different battle. I don't think that's the battle you win. And so when I say it's counterproductive, I think that if Bitcoin was hijacked by the privacy extremist, it would probably kill the network. But by the way, if you really wanted that, why don't you just go to Zcash? You've already got it, right? You've already got it with Monero or Zcash or something. So if that's what you want, why don't you take your money, you want to be private, and just move. I'm not being snarky. I'm serious. Take your money and put the amount that you want to be private in a privacy wallet on Zcash. And the upside is you'll have the privacy, and the downside is you have the risk of them shutting down the entire network. And you live with that. And that's life.
Yeah, I'm fine with Bitcoin, thanks. That's all for me. I wonder, it's the main thing about the privacy thing is, we're coming obviously from completely different ends of the spectrum here. Many people that have been stacking away for the last however long truly believe that they're going to become wealthier than they've ever been before. And that's the fear, I think, where this privacy thing's come from. That they don't want to be a target. Whereas you've been a very wealthy person for a long time, you've probably never ever felt threatened or personally attacked for making your first $1 million sort of thing. Whereas most people on the street here that have been stacking their sats, they've never had that. They still can't get to that point.
Well, I mean, but I guess my point here is I'm not against privacy, and Bitcoin is not non-private, right? I mean, there's a fair degree of privacy in the network. No one's publishing a list of the 100,000 people that have the most money in Bitcoin, right? Well, I haven't seen that list, right? Right? I mean, I haven't seen a list of the top 10, by the way. So, you know, there is a fair degree of privacy in Bitcoin right now. And if someone said, I like the virtue of privacy and I would like to not be outed, I don't disagree with them. I'm not in favor of publishing a list of 50 million wallets along with the social security number and the address of the people, right? What I'm saying is Bitcoin does what it does right now. And it's been successful because it does what it does. I don't think you need to fix it. For example, I don't think that the lack of more privacy is an existential threat to Bitcoin. I don't think the network will be destroyed if you don't change it. I can embrace the idea, with Taproot and Schnorr and multi-sig and the like. I can embrace the fact that some upgrades will be good for it, right? And there are incremental upgrades for security, for privacy, for scalability, and those are good things. So I understand we should do good things in a very careful fashion. I don't have other comments on that. I believe that the fact that people have options is beneficial to the network. Right? Let me say it a different way. If you operate on Bitcoin and no one knows who you are ever and you're anonymous, well, that's a good thing. And the fact that there are self-custody solutions where you never have to rely upon a KYC bank or an exchange, that's a good thing. That keeps everybody honest. But, railing against PayPal which is a totally different thing. It's like, well, you can choose not to use PayPal because you don't like the constraints that PayPal puts on you. And I respect that. On the other hand, if PayPal brings 100 million more users on the network, you'll benefit, even if you're that privacy advocate that doesn't want to be in that system. You'll benefit from it. In fact, every single time another bank or another provider brings on another Bitcoin service or Bitcoin product, it strengthens the entire network for everybody. We all beneficiaries. I'm a beneficiary of what Binance is doing, even though I can't use Binance. And people that use PayPal to buy Bitcoin benefit from Binance. And hodlers that have their own hardware wallets that never use Binance, that never use PayPal, that are disgusted at the anathema of KYC and disgusted at whatever anybody else might do, they benefit economically from the actions of other Bitcoin standard companies. And I wouldn't be so judgmental. Everybody's got their own circumstances, right? It's like there's an orthodoxy, but for the guy that's got PayPal installed that wants to buy $1,000 worth of Bitcoin, telling them they can't do it in 5 seconds and they have to, like, there's this thing with Bitcoiners. They talk about going down the rabbit hole. It's like the guy wants to give you $1,000 and he's going to click once and put the $1,000 in the network. Okay, that's one way. Or the other way is you can tell him to stop and attend a 90-day concentrated course for 500 hours of studying. And then he's got to buy 16 pieces of hardware and he's got to memorize 24 seed key phrases. And then he's got to create 3 backups and 2 safe deposit boxes. And then you beat him half to death so that he can like put $1,000 in the network. And the point is, that, I mean, for the long-term maximalists and the hardcore Bitcoiners, it's a rite of passage and they love that. That's true. But I mean, why don't you just let the guy put the $1,000 on one click on the network and live his life? If it's going to double the price of, if it's going to double the value of your Bitcoin, do you really have to let the perfect be the enemy of the good? If Warren Buffett got up tomorrow morning and he just said, I want to buy $50 billion worth of Bitcoin, just get it done. Are you guys all going to lay down in front of a tank and say he's not allowed to? He hasn't gone down the rabbit hole. He hasn't earned the right. He needs to memorize 24 seeds and get his own hardware wallet. And I don't, he better like go and read a bunch of stuff first, because I would have talked to him about, you know, something or other. Or you're just going to take his money. Take the $50 billion and your Bitcoin's going to triple in value. And it's going to be as private as the precautions that you took to keep it private. And if Bitcoin is not private enough, maybe Taproot will make it better, or, you know, and if that's not good enough, then maybe you'll move some over to Zcash. And there's always the next thing you can go to, right? I mean, make your decision. Let other people make their decision. The guy that operates a regulated insurance company, they don't have the luxury of the debate over, like, you know, the private hardware wallet seed key. You know, it's like they don't have the luxury. Oh, it's... Be empathetic. There's a dude that goes to work that's surrounded by 27 other people, and they don't have the ability to like hold their own keys and do this and that and the other thing. They can put $1 billion on the network, though. They're allowed to do that. And so you have to decide, is Bitcoin inclusive to everybody? And by the way, if I'm in a country and they're going to draw and quarter me if I do it that way, and my choice is I can either give you all my money and not die, or I can take my money and I can try to do it with a DeFi dark network stored hardware asynchronous satellite uplink while on the run, and if they catch me, they're going to murder me and my family. It's like, you know, really, you got to shove your dogma down the guy's throat. Just take his money. He buys the thing. He doesn't have privacy. Maybe his government does whatever they're going to do. Maybe the person suffers. Maybe they don't suffer. what's the skin off your back? You benefited. The guy actually bought in the network. The network price of Bitcoin goes up. You're a beneficiary. So I think live and let live. It's like the survivalist, you know, it's like some people want to buy a flashlight and batteries. Some people want, you know, their own cabin in the woods. Some people want their cabin in the woods with their own generator. Some people want the cabin in the woods with their own generator, and they're going to go ahead and become a doctor, and they're going to stockpile antibiotics against the time when, you know, and then you could always have a little rowing machine to generate your own electricity when the sun goes out. There are different degrees, you know, of buying into the vision. Let everybody decide what they can do, and keep in mind this one last point. Not everybody has a choice. You can convince me. I don't have the power to do it the hardcore way, right? Even if you convince me, I just can't do it, right? And that's the difference between, you know, being open and inclusive, you know, and being exclusionary. The market will make the decision. And I think that everybody should keep in mind in the crypto world, if PayPal doesn't give you the right to self-custody, that's an opportunity, right? They don't. You should be happy they don't, because now you can sell something that they're not selling, right? At the point that PayPal embeds it in their product, it gets harder for Square. At the point that Apple embeds it into Apple Pay, it gets harder for PayPal, right? Right? This thing rolls downhill. And as long as there's someone that's not solving the problem, if Coinbase is not giving you the privacy you like, well, then that's an opportunity for the Zcash people, or, the decentralized exchange, one way or the other. And if you're right in the world, in the marketplace, and in the world, then your idea will prosper and it will grow. And if you're wrong, it will linger and get snuffed out. And that's Darwinism. So it is what it is. The market will decide. Best idea wins. Maybe lots of ideas win. Maybe just a few ideas win. We will see.
But right now we have Bitcoin, and, you know, for me, it's pretty much perfect as it is, and it's been amazing to see you come into the space and shout from the rooftops and tweet about it. Your tweets are poetic, as some people are calling it, and great analogies as well. The famous one, the Cyber Hornet. So it's brilliant. Do I have any time for a few last questions?
Yeah, we should wrap it up in the next couple of minutes, but go ahead. Last one.
All right. Well, I always ask one question at the end of each show, and that is, if you had one orange pill left to give to someone, who would you give that to and why?
You probably ought to give the orange pill to the richest man in the world because he's the richest man in the world.
There you go.
It's a monetary network, after all.
Exactly. And do you think, would you, I know you've said you've been very vocal in the fact that you would never sell Bitcoin. This is something you're going to hodl for 100 years. Is there going to be a point where you will be paying employees or contractors or business suppliers in Bitcoin? When do you envisage?
You know, first of all, I think that Bitcoin is the ideal treasury reserve asset. So for that reason, if you're selling it, you need to be selling it because there's some other asset that's better. And I don't see a better treasury reserve. I wouldn't sell it to buy a bond or a stock or a precious metal or real estate, because I don't think those are better treasury reserve assets. If you're selling it, you probably need to be buying a jet or a yacht, you know, or your dream house, right? Or get married, right? You need to be buying something, a passionate thing, something of passion to save your child's life, right? I mean, I can come up with an idea as to why I might sell, but it needs to be something that involves passion, not a personal thing, not something that involves an investment decision. So that's what I mean when I say that. With regard to paying people, I've articulated this before, but I think the point is it's an asset. It's not a currency. I don't think it's a currency. The tax code is hostile to using a crypto asset as currency. That is to say, every time, if I get paid 1,000 times in Bitcoin, I have 1,000 different taxable acquisitions at different bases. If I pay 1,000 bills, I have 1,000 different transactions, and I have to mark the value of the Bitcoin to the price of Bitcoin at the time I did it and calculate the capital gain or capital loss. The accounting is 1,000,000 times harder. So notwithstanding the first observation, which is I'd have to spend years, 5 years and $10 million to rebuild all my accounting systems to do it, doesn't make a lot of sense. My second observation is I don't think the accounting software companies could do it if I wanted them to. SAP, Oracle, JD Edwards, Workday. I mean, these systems don't support that complicated accounting. So it's a massive systems problem. But the third point is, if your employees wanted Bitcoin, there's no employee of mine that wants 100% to be paid 100% in Bitcoin. What they want is to save Bitcoin, HODL Bitcoin. So why, as an employer, would you presume to dictate to them how much they should have? Just pay them in the local fiat currency and then let them buy whatever they want, whenever they want it. Right? The natural way that a multinational would work is you're paying in 20 different currencies all your bills, and you're receiving all your revenues and all the currencies, and your accounting systems work that way. If you work for me, Daniel, I pay you. You take 20% of your salary, you buy Bitcoin. You take the other 80% of your salary, you pay your operating expenses. Your decision, not my decision, right? As to what you buy and when you buy it. The employees get all the benefit. If employees really wanted Bitcoin, they have the ability to buy Bitcoin. No one's stopping them, right? Like, what if I told you I was going to pay you an Apple stock? Wouldn't you be a little bit irked at me? Like, isn't it kind of presumptive? Like, what if I told you I was going to pay you in bars of gold? Right. So I think that there's a hardcore set of Bitcoiners that love the idea of using it to replace the dollar. But again, now we're back to medium of exchange. And let me say it again. The value of a medium, what do you think the value of medium exchange is, Daniel, in the free market? If Bitcoin was as good a medium of exchange as Apple Pay, what would it be worth extra? Nothing. The value of a medium exchange is nothing. Zero. Nothing. Because Square, PayPal, Apple, Google give it away for free to 7 billion people. And it works 1 billion times faster and better than Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin Satoshi Vision or Bitcoin. It's an oddity. It's like an interesting, cool thing. It has no commercial value. What's the value of like duplicating YouTube's video server on the blockchain? We could do that. Nothing. Right? What's the value of the third best social network? Nothing. That's the problem. The best one has all the value. Once upon a time, they calculated the amount of profit in the mobile phone business, and they found that Apple Computer generated 150% of all the profits in the mobile phone business. Another way of saying, Apple made all the money and every other mobile phone provider lost money in aggregate competing in the space. The value of being in the business was nothing, zero. And so the value of Bitcoin as a store of value is, in theory, up to $250 trillion. The value of Bitcoin as a medium of exchange is nothing. So no, I don't think I'll pay my employees in Bitcoin. But no, it's not because I don't believe in Bitcoin. It's just because I think it's misguided intellectually to try to use Bitcoin like a YouTube streaming video network. or use Bitcoin, you know, like Snapchat. I mean, like, heck, I could use Bitcoin like, you know, like Audible. Do you want to do your podcasting on Bitcoin? There's a million things people do with software. Just because you can do it with software doesn't mean you should do it. And I think that, you know, when we went down that fork, you know, and Roger, he went that, you know, Satoshi Vision and Bitcoin Cash, it was just a fork in the road. And they made this awful strategic mistake because you had a choice, store of value, medium of exchange. Medium of exchange is worth nothing to 7 billion people. It's a commodity. It's given away by Apple and Google. And by the way, and they can do it better because you only need about 1% to 2% of your monetary energy to be in a high-speed medium of exchange at any given time. A store of value is impossible to be delivered. A company can't deliver it. A government can't deliver it. A centralized network can't deliver it. So one of these things was the most important value, the most important invention in the history of the world. And the other of these things was there's probably 1,000 payment networks better than a crypto payment, than the best crypto payment network. And the first one, or the you can probably name the first five or four. And I can't name the next 995. And so at the end of the day, the key here is companies desperately need Bitcoin as a treasury reserve asset. They don't need to rip out their accounting systems. They don't need to rip out their payment systems. They don't need to rip out their payroll systems. They're not, by the way, it's not that I don't get that it's valuable to do the settlement transaction. There's a difference between saying I'm not likely to use it versus saying we shouldn't have it. We need the work that goes in the Lightning Network. We need the BTC Pay server. We need the ability to do transactions peer-to-peer on the settlement network because it's the deterrent value. It's the ability to move the money from one bank to another bank or one counterparty to another counterparty. The fact that you know I could do it if I needed to do it, which is what keeps you honest. The freedom to transact. The freedom to transact is extremely valuable, but the transaction speed and utility of doing it a billion times as frequently is not so valuable. So back to Stoicism, just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you should do a thing. It's absolutely essential that Bitcoin should be able to transact. And if you know, if you're my bank and if you're my counterparty, if you're my government, and if you know I can transact, that's going to protect my asset a billion times a month. It's going to protect my asset billions and billions and billions and billions of times because every possible conceivable attack, right, might be thwarted by the fact that I have a backdoor. So it's an important capability, but there's a difference between knowing you. It's like the gun in your house. You have a gun in your house. Maybe you want people that would do harm to you to know you have a gun in the house, but you don't fire off the gun 19 times a day. You're just going to hit yourself in the foot with the gun. So it's a deterrent. It's a nuclear deterrent, right? Just like the nuclear deterrent that maybe stops a war, maybe. That's the way I see transaction capabilities on the blockchain. It's a very important deterrent. But to then decide that I got to use it just because I could use it, it takes me to another place. And that doesn't make any sense, nor is it necessary.
Love it, man. Really do. And I just got one last final question for you. And you can be as short as the answers you like. Obviously, you've tweeted about running the node. Have you considered asking your employees to all spin up a node? How many do you have, employees?
2,000 employees. Look, I mean, the amount of Bitcoin that we do, I announced we ran one node, but that's just what I put out in the public. I'm not going to tell everybody everything that we do just because it's inappropriate for security purposes and also for competitive purposes and the like. But you could expect that we will actually engage in a lot more Bitcoin activity as time comes by, right? I can't do everything immediately everywhere. And even if I could, I'm not telling everybody, right? For obvious reasons. But you can probably infer that I'm enthusiastic and the company's enthusiastic and we see lots of opportunity here and we expect to invest across the ecosystem in a variety of ways.
Excellent. Michael, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And everything that you bring into the space, it's amazing to have a whale on our side and a whale that's not going to be looking to dump, which has happened many times in the past. You've lifted the price floor, and you've and a personal thanks from the guys at Tahini's. I don't know if you follow them on Twitter.
Yeah,
the
they're Canadian great. Big fan.
I interviewed Ali the other day, and he said, please say thanks, because it was your news that pushed them over the edge to get into a Bitcoin standard for their own family business. And it's definitely making a huge dent, man. You're affecting people's lives and thinking. And it's great to have you along for the ride.
I'm inspired by Tahini, and I think that they're inspirational for a lot of other businesses. And I think that this is a very formative stage for Bitcoin. I think people still... There's a first generation who are speculators and traders, and I don't think they really appreciated what they had. And there's another generation, they're going to see this as the world's first perfected digital monetary network. And it's an engineering feat. And you have an opportunity to plug your treasury, your monetary system into a digital monetary system, the best digital monetary system. It's not a speculation, right? It's not a financial instrument. It's not a cool investment idea. It's not some kind of like summer romance, right? The Romans invented aqueducts. You have the ability of an aqueduct in your town. Are you going to like turn it on for the summer and turn it off and trade it and sell it? It's an aqueduct, right? That's what Bitcoin is. It's an aqueduct. It's electricity. You can have electricity to your town, right? Once you get that idea, it's electricity, dude. Like, well, I thought I'd trade it and then I will like sell it at the end of the summer and wait for it to like be cheaper. It's like, it's electricity. You want to shake these people, you know? And I think that Tahini, helps with that. When people adopt the Bitcoin standard, it helps with that. As we start to explain, this is a feat of engineering wonder. When we engineered steel plants and we were able to create steel, it's like, it's steel. Like, we thought we'd build a town with steel and then we'd stop and for the next 30 years we'll build with wood. No, it's steel. We invented steel. We invented electricity. We invented aqueducts. I give you a bridge. It's a bridge. We're going to have it this summer, but when are you going to tear down the bridge? I'm not tearing down the bridge. It's a dam. Right? Like the challenge is to communicate to people. It's a fundamental engineering advancement that underpins the progress of the human race. When for the first time in the history of the human race, we're able to store and channel monetary energy without power loss. Like a nuclear reactor, like something, it's big. It's a bit, we're flying airplanes. For the first time in history, we can fly in a plane and not crash and burn. You're going to use that this summer and you're going to sell the airplane so you can buy, a sailboat. No, I am not going to sell the airplane. It's an airplane. It's something impressive. People that trade it, they don't understand it. They just seriously don't understand what this thing is. If they understood what it is, the only question they'd be asking is, how do I get more?
Exactly.
Okay, with that, I guess we ring off. Daniel, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Michael. Where should people come and find you if they want to reach out and want to hear more from you?
Well, Twitter, Michael Saylor, Michael_Saylor at Twitter is the best place to follow any of my thoughts. If they want to know more about Bitcoin and how I think about Bitcoin, go to hope.com, H-O-P-E. Bitcoin is hope. You'll find stuff. Thank you.
Don't forget Saylor.org, right, for the education.
Thank you. Yes. If they want free education, or if they know anybody that wants free education, go to Saylor.org. It's all free. I think we added 80,000 students in the past 12 weeks. You know, people are starting to figure it out. We had quite a few every day. It's hard to give away stuff for free, Daniel. So just if you spread the word, it's free. Tell people that want free education. The world would be a better place if we educated more people.
100%. Michael, thanks so much. And I look forward to the next time we do this.
Okay, have a good one.
Hey guys, thank you for listening. And thank you, Michael, for coming on the show. And we went over time, apologize for that. But the last few questions, we got into some other topics. Really appreciate all your time and everything that you've done for the space so far. Lots to unpack from that episode. Obviously, a favorite topic of mine, as many of the long-term listeners will know, his thoughts around education and how that sector is going to get turned upside down in the next 10 years and a complete transition away from everything we've known for the last 100 to 150 years of this defunct system that we still insist on pushing on families, which does not serve families. It doesn't serve the kids, doesn't serve the parents. It certainly does not serve the teachers, those who have this calling to educate but just have to navigate this bureaucratic administrative system of bullshit and teach, not even teach in the manner that they can or want to teach. They're told how to teach, what to teach, when to teach it, from what books to teach it from. It's just so dumb that we're still doing this. And to hear someone like Michael back up those beliefs that I've held for the last 6 years since exiting the mainstream education system and looking at it as an outsider looking in, as we were talking about. So to have someone like that finally come out and lay it out as well as he did, and to see the vision as well as he does, the virtual wave, and how, and build an online platform where people can go and learn absolutely anything for free. That just makes my heart sing. That I mean, all of the Bitcoin chat, that was all brilliant as well. But the fact that we've got people like Michael with his reach and his means building something like this that is just such another monumental shift in the right direction for humanity and society at large is brilliant. And, you know, let's go. Let's really, really go. Because we just need more and more people like this doing this and driving people forward and into areas of life that they're really going to excel at, something that they are passionate to study. You cannot stop someone when they are passionate about something. Look at us all here. We are passionate about Bitcoin. If there was a Bitcoin class to go to every day, you'd go for 10 hours a day. And you know you would. And think of the things you would learn and the rabbit holes you would get pulled into. Every facet of Bitcoin, you just want to suck that knowledge up and you wouldn't complain about it. It wouldn't feel like work. In fact, you'd go at the weekends if you could. But of course, no, we don't have that opportunity. And kids don't have that opportunity because we just bow to this nonsense system that we've just I don't know, we've been the boiling frogs of the education system. We got to jump out. there's no other way to put it. We've got to jump out. So really great to get into that conversation. And all of the Bitcoin conversations, wherever they went, talking about the privacy thing and getting his point of view from someone he can't even engage in it. Like engage in a private coin. It's not even a thing for him because of his standing as a company and as a CEO. And to hear that side of it and where he thinks it's going and where the price floors are going to be set because of the bigger institutions that are going to start coming in that have the same kind of battles that he faced. They're not going to be coming in on BISC and HODL. That's for the plebs right now, and that's great. In fact, that could even be better. You know, the taco eaters at the bottom of this, we can stack away and like he said, stack however you want to stack. It doesn't really make that much of a difference if you want to go and stack privately, then go ahead and do it. And we have that option. And yeah, I mean, if you want to stack on PayPal, then I guess, again, it's a good point. We all had our first touch points and we've all been down the rabbit hole. It's all we can do is steer those people that are coming behind us. But if we're shouting too loud about it, we can provide the education and be there in the DMs and ready to respond and ready to help friends and family. But at the end of the day, if someone can do it at touch of the button, that's going to be their first touch point. I guess that's their first touch point. And then it's our duty, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh touch points, however long it takes, to then slowly just help everybody around us understand the next step and then the next step and then the next step. Which, if you think about the legacy financial system, none of us ever had that, right? You kind of shamed into, you got to open a bank account and that's it. You don't know how it works, what's going on behind the scenes. You don't know really why you're doing it. You don't understand half of it. What's a mortgage rate? What's an interest rate? What's this, that, and the other derivative? What's this thing over here, this air quote savings vehicle? Whereas as Bitcoiners, we can definitely take the opposite stance to that and help people understand it very slowly and in their own time. And everybody's different. So it was great to get into that conversation and everything else that we touched on as well. I'll leave it there. Thanks again, Michael, so much for coming on. I've got another show lined up with Michael, which I'm very much looking forward to. We'll be dropping that in a few weeks' time with another guest. Jeff Booth will be joining us to do a special show there, talking very much about Bitcoin in the boardroom and what that landscape is going to be looking like over the next 5 years or so. So thanks, everybody, as usual, for listening. Make sure you go big up the sponsors of the show. And if you do want to start stacking some sats in the UK, coinfloor.co.uk/bitten. They will do it right for you, as will swanbitcoin.com/oncebitten in the US. Those are two great companies that will hold your hand and will give you all the education that you need and help you start stacking your sats. So go check both those companies out. Big thanks to @hodlerthannow. The Britcoiners over at 21ism doing amazing work. Adam Woodhams 1 for putting this together, and Jim Reaper for the website, man. Really appreciate it. That's once-bitten.com. You can share that around with your friends and family. Episodes link straight to that. And you can find out a little bit more about myself and check out my book as well, which is called Choose Life. Thanks, everybody. Really appreciate everybody listening, showing up for the show each week, going from strength to strength with the guests that are coming on. And it's all because you guys are showing interest and sharing and commenting and liking. Appreciate everybody. Big love. Let's go. 15K. When 16. When moon. See you guys.